Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. Today, I am joined by one of my producers over on my other show, Mile Higher, Ian.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, man, how are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to be sitting in the chair.
Fine. Yeah, in the chair. What do you think of these chairs?
Like you were saying, it forces you to have good posture. So
it does. There's no leaning back.
No, it's impossible.
Yeah, it's not the most comfortable chair, but they do look cool, that's for sure. But today we're going to be covering a very important case, and a case that's near and dear to my heart, as well as Mile High Media just in general, because this is the unsolved murder of 14-year-old Brandi Hutchins. And her case is just, it got really messed up because of the time period that her murder took place in 1988. So we're kind of in the height of the satanic panic.
Right.
And, you know, we've covered a ton of satanic panic cases on the show. And what we see time and time again is authorities at the time looking at very crude evidence and making a judgment based on very little. And their judgment usually ends up going in the complete wrong direction, which is what happens in this case. Because when they look at the crime scene, they immediately think a group of Satanists or occultists must have done this.
Right, and it's disappointing to see this, not only in this case, but in every case, and we'll talk about a few others when we get to it, but it's disappointing to see how not only investigators more or less fall for this, but also how the media pushes it so heavily.
Right.
And that influences everything. It taints the whole well.
And once that happens, it's very hard to come back from that.
Right.
And also just precious time is lost. People who may have been involved, the murderer themselves, may have ample time to get away. And I really feel like that's the case here is, you know, because they kind of went on this wild goose chase and really, really thought, especially at the beginning, that this was some type of ritualistic killing, that ultimately that's the reason why her murder is still unsolved. And her cousin, Julie, amazing person, continues to fight for justice for Brandi. And she was a recipient of a Higher Hope grant, which is awesome. So we were able to help her fund some things that she was working on and help her get some more resources that she needs in that fight, which is always awesome to be able to do. But yeah, this is a very, very sad case. She was only 14 years old at the time of her murder. And after all these years, still no answers. So if we go back to the very beginning of this case, Brandi Dawn Hutchins, she was born on November 5th, 1974 in Johnson County, Arkansas. She was the only child of Jerry and Mary Hutchins. Jerry was not Brandy's biological father. He and Mary actually met and got married while she was pregnant with her. But Jerry absolutely loved Brandi and happily took on the role of being her dad. He became the only father she ever knew. And as a child, she was also very close to her cousin, Julie Millard, who described Brandi as bubbly and a happy child. She was also very giving and would pull things out of her own toy box to give to others for Christmas. Unfortunately, Brandi had a very complex and troublesome life almost straight out of the gate. Mary was an emotionally toxic mother, and Brandi never knew what to expect from her. And at times, she would spoil Brandi by giving her whatever she wanted, but then she would get angry and lash out at her. And in many ways, Mary made it known that she didn't want her child. But that would become even more apparent as time went on. In 1984, when Brandi was only 10 years old, Jerry and Mary decided to move the family to Iowa to get a fresh start. And after only being there for a few months, Mary began seeing another man. She told Jerry that she was leaving him and wouldn't be taking Brandy with her. But she wasn't honest with Brandy about what was happening. Instead, she simply told her that she was going to the grocery store and would return home in a little bit. The only thing was she never came back. And after this, Jerry and Brandy moved back to Johnson County, Arkansas. But things weren't ideal when they returned. The two of them moved in with Jerry's two brothers in a two-bedroom trailer. And Brandy really didn't like living there and would often be gone for days at a time. And when she did this, she often stayed at some of her friends' houses. But Brandy was also known as just a happy kid. You know, she was outgoing. She was silly. She seemed to get along with people. But all of these massive life changes, especially in a 14-year-old, are going to take a toll. And, you know, it could create some, you know, sort of resentment as well as just kind of amplifying sort of that rebelness that comes with just being a teenager, right?
Right. Well, and I also think like when you grow up in such a, you know, for lack of a better word, like toxic environment with her mother, and then that is removed. I mean, that is the ground in which she was raised, regardless of if it was good or not. So with that gone, even though it was not stable, she feels like, or she might feel like her world is completely changed. And, you know, Jerry seems like a great guy. But to her, you know, it's like he's the nice one to me. Where's the mean one? So she might have to provide that sort of toxicity that she's used to, really.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. I think she's, you know, when you're that young, and I know from going through sort of a phase like this myself, that it can be, you know, when you're moving around and changing environments at that age is really tough because you really need to be grounded. You really need to, you know, build those friendships and build those relationships. And when that's all sort of ripped away from you, and then you have the fact that her mother just took off, I mean, that's going to be extremely traumatic in itself and difficult to deal with. And so, you know, she kind of develops this sort of, you know, more defiant, angry personality and starts sort of having this lack of respect for authority. And, you know, that's some of that is sort of just normal teenage behavior, right? But obviously it's going to be amplified when you consider all the other circumstances going on. But Brandy did keep in touch with her mother over the phone, but she obviously struggled with the abandonment issues. She began acting out, often getting in trouble at school. She would talk back to teachers and even physically fight with other kids. The adults in her life didn't really know how to properly handle some of her behavioral issues. And at times, her family said it was just easier to sort of let her do whatever she wanted, which, you know, makes sense. And that happens a lot. But here's a clip of Brandy's cousin, Julie, describing her.
She was a whole bunch of stuff rolled up into one ball. She was very sweet, bubbly. She never met a stranger, ever. She was very giving and generous. She was happy all the time. I mean, she's always had a smile on her face. Brandy also was very troubled and had behavior problems and didn't have a real stable home life. I think she would have went anywhere and done anything just to be accepted and loved, you know, which I think is probably what ultimately got her into so much trouble.
But Julie suspected that Brandy might have had oppositional defiant disorder, which the Mayo Clinic defines as a frequent and ongoing pattern of anger, irritability, arguing, and defiance toward parents and other authority figures. Julie said discipline was never consistent with Brandy. She became very strong-willed, and when she wanted something, she wouldn't take no for an answer. A counselor named Mary Ellen Patton, who worked at the Johnson County Westside Elementary where Brandy went to school, said this. Now, this has been a long time ago, but Brandy was not from a home where she would have been sheltered. She was definitely troubled and a wanderer. She was not one to go home after school to be supervised. She was always out and about, and she was very boy crazy. Many characterized Brandy even as an outsider. And so you kind of hear sort of that description. I think it paints a very clear picture of just what Brandy's struggles were at the time and not having that lack of structure,
right,
or having a parental figure sort of guide them during this period. And if that just sort of is allowed to run wild, I mean, it can go a lot of different ways,
right?
And not necessarily in a good direction. While her father, Jerry, absolutely loved Brandy, he simply wasn't equipped to be a single father, especially in the 1980s when there simply wasn't adequate mental health resources for a struggling child. And it seems like no one was able to understand that her behavioral problems may have been directly related to the instability she dealt with at such a young age, which is interesting.
Right. Well, and I think that that is still true to this day. I think a lot of people, especially when teenagers are going through something like this, you know, we might say like, oh, it's just normal teenage behavior, which it often is, but not recognizing that there is a base from which that's coming from, you know, that there's a childhood, there are conditions that have created this that can be helped. But if you don't have the resources to do so, or you don't even know how to access those resources, you know, there's no way really to curb this kind of.
No, there's not. And I mean, if anyone's been in therapy before, you know how it works, right? It's right. Always going to go back to your childhood. It's always going to go back to your relationship with your parents and what that looked like, because those are the root of
everything,
most, if not all, issues, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it makes sense, especially since, again, this was the 1980s, just a different time period, the resources. And I mean, this is a small town in Arkansas too, right? So, you know, I'm sure the mental health resources were limited, if they had any at all.
Right.
But since Jerry struggled to raise her, Brandy often lived with her cousin, Julie Millard, and her husband and two children. But Brandy continued to act out, and this ultimately led to Brandy's expulsion from school at the age of 13, which is a pretty big deal to be expelled from school that young.
No, I mean, me personally, I don't think I've met or known anyone. You know, that speaks to like a serious issue that
right.
is just not being addressed.
Which the state did intervene at this time, and the Department of Child and Family Services ordered Brandy to seek treatment at a specialty school for children who are emotionally struggling. And so she went and attended that program and completed it. And after that, she was able to re-enter the county school system. But the facility didn't have a bed for her yet, so Brandy had to wait until a space opened up. And it was around this time that a very big change happened for her.
So in September of 1988, Brandy went to a local carnival, and while there, she made a new friend. This friend had an older brother who was 17, and Brandy immediately had a huge crush on him. This guy's name has never been publicly released, so for the purpose of the story, we'll refer to him as Aaron. So Brandy's feelings for Aaron grew very quickly. She would go over to her friend's house, pretending to want to hang out, but really, she was only ever there to get closer to Aaron. She even wrote, "I love Aaron," on the shoes she wore every day. If we remember earlier, you know, people were already saying she's boy crazy. So if there's someone who's actually able to receive this affection, of course it's reaching these new heights.
I mean, to write "I love Aaron" on your shoes is kind of a big sign, you know.
Huge like, sign.
This could be an unhealthy relationship, an unhealthy obsession. And certainly a distraction.
Right. Well, and he's also older, you know, and there's, I mean, we don't know the guy, but I think it's safe to say that he might be taking advantage of this. He's noticing this obsession and is maybe playing into it.
Totally.
I don't know about you, but I like to keep my money where I can see it. Unfortunately, traditional big wireless carriers also seem like keeping my money too. After years of overpaying for wireless from the big companies, I finally got fed up with all the crazy little fees, all the crazy high wireless bills seem to go up and up each year, and that's when I started thinking about Mint Mobile. My contract's coming up to an end here, and I'm looking to switch my family over to Mint Mobile because it just makes sense. Why overpay for the same coverage, the same speeds, the same unlimited talk, text, and data, when you don't have to? Mint Mobile is here to rescue with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. I mean, that is just such an insane deal. And all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G networks. Bring your own phone number and phone if you want to. You can activate with an eSIM in minutes. It's super easy. Our Higher Hope Foundation coordinator's phone is a Mint Mobile phone, and I set that up. Actually, it was extremely easy. It took me less than 10 minutes to get a new eSIM for her phone. And it's worked flawlessly since, and it's saved us tons of money. And what's great about Mint Mobile that a lot of the other carriers don't do is that there's no long-term contracts or commitments. You get to ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless services from Mint Mobile for just $15 a month. At the end of the day, with the big carriers, you're paying for the marketing, you're paying for a lot of the other things that Mint Mobile doesn't charge you for. It's just a no-brainer. Why pay more for the same coverage?
Switch to Mint Mobile. You'll thank yourself later, and your wallet will thank you right now. So if you like your money, Mint Mobile's for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/lightsout. That's mintmobile.com/lightsout. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
So part of the reason she felt this way was that he showed her kindness and attention, something that Brandy just didn't receive very often. It didn't take long for him to take advantage of how smitten she was with him, and the two started having a sexual relationship. And she was 13 and he was 17 at the time. This made Brandy believe that the two of them were dating, even though Aaron never claimed her as his girlfriend. Still, she was under the impression that they were in a relationship, and she did everything she could to keep him to herself. So, on November 5th, 1988, Brandy turned 14. And while we don't know exactly how she celebrated that day, reportedly, she was told that friends would be throwing her a birthday party. To this day, it's unknown who told her this, but there's proof of an invitation in the form of a post-it note that said, "Meet me at the old house." Before that could happen, she had something important to take care of. On November 8th, she informed her dad that she was pregnant with Aaron's baby. And of course, as we get through the story, we'll see this is one of the more interesting elements of it, but she also told Jerry that the two of them wanted to get married and asked him to sign the wedding certificate. Legally, they needed this from her parents since she was still a minor. Jerry absolutely refused and told her to wait until she was 18. But Brandy was determined to make it happen. Again, she's defiant. She wants her way. So she told her dad that she would go to Iowa and get her mother, Mary, to sign it for her. The next day, Brandy told Jerry about the birthday party her friends were throwing for her. But he told her that she was not allowed to go because it was actually being thrown at the old John Emery house, an abandoned home on Whippoorwill Road in Coal Hill, Arkansas. Town folklore says it got its name from the man who lived there decades ago, and over the years, it became nothing more than a dilapidated structure. And in the late 80s, teenagers would often use it as a place to party.
So I feel like this was a pretty common occurrence, especially in the 80s, you know, going to the woods and finding an old abandoned structure and, you know, doing whatever, partying in it.
I mean, we even had that in the early 2000s in Golden. There was like this old mine on the Mace, on the Mesa, not the Mace. and same sort of situation. We'd go there. We'd have airsoft wars. It would be a place to get away from your parents, still be kind of enclosed.
That's sweet. I wish I lived somewhere where there's somewhere abandoned. It's just open fields for miles around me. It was like the one place that we would go to that sort of had some haunted history to it was just like an old bridge.
See, but bridges can be really, really
they
quiet.
Can be fun. They can be fun. So Brandy didn't give up on what she wanted. She begged her father to let her go. And after a while, her begging and pleading eventually worked. Jerry caved in and agreed that she could go. On November 10th, the day of the party, Brandy spent most of it in her room where she wrote a letter to Aaron. And while we don't know the contents of this letter, her family believes that she was telling him about her pregnancy and planned to give him the letter that night. Then around 4 p.m., Jerry took Brandy to the party. She also borrowed $5 from one of her uncles so she could stop along the way to buy some cigarettes. And back then, plenty of store clerks often didn't mind selling cigarettes to children. She's 13 years old. They're like, whatever.
Whatever. A sale's a sale.
Right. No ID required. So she picked up a pack of Marlboros and went on her way. After that, Jerry and Brandy arrived at the old John Emery house. Before she got out of the car, Jerry had some type of, you know, feeling or inclination that something bad may happen. And so at that last moment, he told her that she couldn't go. But obviously, that's going to be very tough to convince her at this point because she desperately wanted to enjoy the birthday party and she reassured her dad that everything would be okay. Brandy also told Jerry that she wouldn't be home for a couple of days, which I'd be like, if I was her paternal figure, I'd be like, what?
What the fuck?
What kind of party is this? Right. Yeah, very strange. And maybe, you know, again, she was staying with a lot of friends and kind of out of the house a lot. And so maybe this wasn't, you know, that shocking to him. But right. I think it was probably still gave him some cause for concern of like, okay, you're going to party and then no idea where you're going to be.
Right. You're going to be gone for days.
After the party, her plan was to go spend the night at Aaron's house because the next day they would head to Iowa so that she could get her mom to sign off on the marriage certificate. Brandy told her father that she loved him and gave him a kiss on the cheek before she got out of the car. He then watched her walk towards this dilapidated, deteriorating house before driving off. And this was sadly the last time that Jerry would ever see his daughter alive, which I came in. It's just a horrible thing to think about.
Especially when you have this feeling of like,
something's not right here.
This intuition of like, it's bad. And you just see her walk off. I can't imagine it.
And he's like, she's going to do what she's going to do regardless. So he's in a really tough position. But unfortunately, Jerry's instincts were spot on. This party invitation was only a lure for Brandy to come to the old John Emery house, because after that, she never came home that night. And 2 days later, on November 12th, two deer hunters were out in the nearby area when their dog ran off. So they went searching for their dog, and that's when they came across a purse and a shoe sticking out from the root cellar of this old John Emery house. And quick reminder for those that don't know, a root cellar is a small storage area typically used for, you probably guess it, root vegetables. But since the house was run down, it was easily accessible from the outside. And it was a very small area. It was only about 4 feet high, so the hunters had to crouch down in order to get in there and take a look. And that's when they noticed a human leg. At that point, they backed up, immediately left the scene, and called the police. And when the police arrived at the house, that's when they found Brandy's body. She was put in a small dug-up hole with old wooden boards laid on top as a way to try and conceal her. And it was very apparent that she had died from a single gunshot wound, point-blank range to the right side of her forehead, and it appeared to have been a .22 caliber bullet. At the scene, police found a post-it note that said, "Meet me at the old house," as well as an empty pack of Marlboros, which was the cigarettes that Brandy had purchased, and they also found paperwork from a health clinic with Brandy's name on it. And on this paperwork, it was the positive pregnancy test that she had recently gotten. As the police investigated the scene, they found satanic markings, they believed, all throughout the house. There were pentagrams, 666, and even KKK were written all over the walls. They also saw red rum, which we all know, murder backwards, and, very famous from The Shining, Stephen King's novel, but this was all over the place. And I think, you know, especially during this time period, this is like when this is all huge, right? This is all, you know, it's kind of this shift in culture and, you know, a lot of new movies and different types of novels are coming out. And so rather than sort of looking at the scene and being like, this is just a bunch of kids.
Yeah, there's a bunch of hair,
just writing a bunch of crazy stuff on the walls. Cause I mean, this was sort of the rise of Satanism and Anton LaVey and, you know, this counterculture movement. So rather than kind of like putting the pieces together, they're looking at this like, oh my God, this has got to be a ritual site for a group of Satanists to perform their disgusting rituals just based off of the writing.
Right. When, of course, to us looking back, we're like, this is clearly just kids writing on an abandoned building.
Which still happens all the time.
To this day. And you know, kids especially are going to write the most heinous shit possible. And at this point in time, with, like you're saying, the media, everything else going around, the satanic panic, the Satanists and everything, it's like, of course they're going to write 666 KKK, the most offensive things they can think of, because that's the soup they're living in, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's just like, it's fuck you. You know, they just want to say fuck you to whoever comes across their hideout. And the cops are just completely shocked by this. And they're, it immediately worries them because, again, most police departments, especially in these small town areas, they're getting fed all this media, right? And they're hearing all over the country, all of these satanic ritual abuse cases going on. And they're also hearing about these other ritualistic murders. You got Charles Manson, you got all of these crazy things going on. And so they're just kind of going off of that. Like, what's the zeitgeist at the time?
And
instead of actually looking at the evidence and looking, and also, you know, really looking at any alternative at this point, they also found rope and wires hanging from the rafters of the home, which they started putting two and two together. And they're like, those must have been used for hanging animals,
right?
During the animal sacrifices that are going on during these satanic rituals. And because of all this, the police and the community quickly assumed that Brandy's murder must have been some type of ritualistic sacrifice to Satan or some other evil entity. And it was at this point that her murder really got wrapped up into the satanic panic craze. And Arkansas was definitely familiar with this because one of the most infamous cases, I think, of all time, and especially in relation to the satanic panic, the West Memphis Three, also happened here. And so let's talk a little bit more just about the satanic panic phenomenon and some of these other cases and how they may have impacted Brandy's case.
Right. So the satanic panic phenomenon really peaked in the 1980s and into the early 1990s, which, you know, it caused mass hysteria over the occult and Satanism. And it led to a widespread belief that groups of Satanists were secretly operating in average American communities. And I think it's important to note, like, in these particular communities that we're talking about, small towns in Arkansas, it's already going to be a pretty religious
Bible Belt.
Like, this is the
Deep
kind
South,
of,
yeah.
Right. This is what, again, we're talking about the zeitgeist, the soup that they're existing in. Even these police officers, you know, if they go to church and as part of sermons, they're hearing, you know, fire and brimstone.
There's evil at our doorstep.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they go out in the world and this is all they're surrounded by. You know, I understand why it could kind of break their brains in a way.
Totally. And it's not to say that there's never been a satanic ritual killing, because there's plenty of killings that had some direct connection to somebody who was murdering someone in the name of Satan. It definitely exists. But the frequency at which that happens over the years is very, very small,
right,
in comparison to all crime in general. And I mean, just doing the show for as long as I have, I've seen how many times where cases just get connected to it through these loose, you know, pieces of evidence, and the real killers just walking free or is right there hiding in plain sight, and they get completely overlooked because there was this psychological fear, you know, you can almost say like psyop going on of like,
basically,
you know, there's these evil Satanists all over the place. And, you know, we saw that rear its head in recent years, even to some extent, and it still kind of exists today. Obviously not in the same, you know, level,
right.
You know, now there's, I think most of us are educated enough to know that Satanists, you know, if you look at like Satanism as a religion or a philosophical group, they're not actually taking part in ritualistic sacrifices of children or anybody for that matter, or even animals. And, that, you know, obviously like with any group, there's always going to be those, you know, sort of extreme,
the most radical
examples of people doing that, but it's so, so small.
Right.
Way smaller than I think most people even realize.
Right. Well, and I think it's just, it's creating this fear. And I think the satanic panic in particular, that fear was even further churned by grifters, you know,
totally.
Like so many other.
Capitalize off of it, as we'll talk about.
Because many point to the release of the 1980 book, Michelle Remembers, as being the first cause for the paranoia. Now, it was written by psychiatrist Lawrence Pazder and his patient, Michelle Smith. And the book chronicles Dr. Pazder as he worked with Michelle through recovered memories of abuse at the hands of the Church of Satan. The book contains some pretty wild claims, including that Michelle experienced torture, witnessed human sacrifices, and was forced to participate in rituals that included painting her face with infant blood. And, you know, I think back to Teal Swan on A Mile Higher. This whole phenomenon of recovered memories, learning that people in your community were doing these horrible things to you as a child, it really has a grasp on people, no matter how, even to this day, right? Teal Swan was only a few years ago. You know, so to have this happen in 1980 and everyone's reading about it.
And it's a book written by a psychiatrist.
Right.
So people are going to automatically see, you know, that sort of that credible, name and author that they're going to probably have a higher chance of believing it.
Right. It's no longer in the religious world, you know.
And it's extreme.
It's crazy.
It's like, what, human sacrifices and infant blood? It's going to strike fear in anybody. And at the time, especially, very little people actually understood the Church of Satan, understood Anton LaVey's sort of point of view. And again, I'm not saying that to defend Anton LaVey. I kind of think he was a piece of shit, but and a grifter for sure.
Right.
But that was the thing, is nobody really stopped to think, maybe these people are just capitalizing off of our fear.
Right.
And how legitimate is this? And, you know, again, their claims.
Right.
Like, where's the evidence? And I think that's been sort of my thought this entire time, especially when talking about the satanic panic, was if all these things are happening and there was, you know, a lot of people that made a lot of wild claims and, you know, or claimed to be there, they saw it, but it was like, there's very little evidence to back up that these human sacrifices occurred, that there, you know, there were these rituals going on. And, you know, like, again, it's not to say that it didn't happen, but to blast this out to the masses and have journalistic publications putting this in their headlines is not good for society.
No, dude, it's clearly it's not. I mean, as we see, you know, from early on, the book did face many accusations of lying, with Anton LaVey actually even threatened to sue Michelle and Lawrence Pazder for libel, which forced them to concede that the Church of Satan wasn't responsible for abuse, while also claiming that the book was accurate. And this is also, like, the Pandora's box already opened. Cat's out of the bag with this. It doesn't matter if they had to admit that the Church of Satan, you know, wasn't responsible for the abuse. That's still out already. People are still believing that.
Right.
And as if Lawrence Pazder wasn't questionable enough, he married Michelle, his former patient, just a few years after the book was released.
Conflict of interest much?
Major.
Yeah.
Major.
Yeah, it's wild.
But none of this stopped Michelle Remembers from being a massive hit. Lawrence Pazder was then considered a satanic ritual abuse expert. The book and supposed satanic abuse were featured on various talk shows. In 1988, the same year Brandy was murdered, Geraldo Rivera, who, talk about grifters.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about ratings and views.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, holy shit, people are going crazy for this. He actually hosted a primetime special on NBC called Devil Worship, Exposing Satan's Underground.
Ooh.
I know, it sounds enticing, right? The show included details about supposed ritualistic abuse by Satanists and alleged testimonials from those who claimed to be survivors of it. The ratings were, like we're talking about here, they were through the roof with over 20 million viewers. It also added fuel to the fire and helped grow an irrational fear of the occult in the American zeitgeist.
1,000%. I mean,
right.
To have a massive show with a massive audience like that, you know, and again, if people are claiming that they were abused and they want to tell their stories, there's no issue with that. It's,
right.
It's further perpetuating all the other things that they have little to no evidence to back up.
Right.
And blasting it out to 20 million people,
the masses.
Right?
Like, I mean, it's right. It's not on the alleged survivors. It's on Geraldo Rivera. It's on Lawrence Pazder for presenting this to the masses without any sort of context or even justification for it.
Right. And like, what in providing a sort of a other look at it of like, well, how rampant is this?
Right.
And what are the facts behind it? Where did this take place? Is this an isolated incident? You know, they didn't look at it critically. It was just like, this is scary. This is horrible. And everybody should be concerned. Everybody in America.
Everybody's at risk.
Yes. That this could happen anywhere. And even though we don't have a ton of concrete proof to trace all the different trails, like, but we do have people saying that this is happening. So that's all we need. And beware.
Beware. So with all this talk of Satanism, people became fearful that they would fall victim to it. So this actually led to baseless theories and claims of ritualistic murder or abuse all throughout the country. And of course, Arkansas was not immune to this hysteria.
Building a quality wardrobe can be a real pain. And for me, it always has been. I'm always going through different brands. I'm always looking for better quality clothing. But that all changed when I found Quince. Quince has been a life changer for me because I hate buying clothing that only lasts through like two washes, or it shrinks, or it just seems to fall apart at the seams. That is not the case with Quint's clothing or really any of their items. They're all top quality. Really happy that I found Quint's because I've gotten so many new jackets, sweaters. I've got some really nice cashmere overcoats. I got a new pea coat. I've just been upgrading all of my jackets and even my loungewear. They have some of the most comfortable lounge pants that I've ever come across. And I literally put those suckers on almost every single day because they are so comfortable. Quince has high quality items at a very, very fair price, considering they feel like luxury designer items, but not at the high designer cost. They have so many versatile pieces depending on the seasons. You can really build out a complete wardrobe with Quince for all times of the year. Quince works directly with top factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. The cashmere is 100% Mongolian, which is the same stuff that the luxury brands use. The Pima cotton is long staple, which means it stays soft and doesn't pill. Everything is built to hold up to regular wear and tear and still look good. Their clothing is rated between 4.5 and 5 stars by thousands of people wearing it every day. When you spend money at Quince, you're going to get what you pay for. You're going to get the quality that lasts. I continue to buy from Quince because I just love everything that I've gotten from them. And I know you will too. Right now, go to quince.com/lightsout for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to build your wardrobe and love it, and you will. Now available in Canada too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/lightsout for free shipping and 365-day returns. It's quince.com/lightsout. Because the first well-known case of satanic panic in Arkansas occurred in 1978 in Bentonville, about 2 hours north of where Brandy lived. A farmhand, Steve Ferguson, had been hauling rocks when he came across a pile of stone that he claimed that looked like a satanic altar. After this, he called the sheriff, who thought this could be linked to the recent animal mutilations going on. The farmhand then found two other piles of rocks. One had a plastic human skull, some candles, and a large knife, and someone had left the message in white letters, "Zido's wrath is upon you." The sheriff then visited a local bookstore because he had no idea what he was looking at. He had no idea what that message meant and picked up some books on demonology. And after reading them, he became convinced, just off of that one altar, that a satanic society was secretly operating in Bentonville. Just off of finding what they thought was an altar.
Right. With a plastic skull.
Right. It's yeah. Could be a Halloween set.
Exactly.
Right. But because of the satanic panic, they're scared, which this made the town fly into mass panic with rumors swirling and people warning each other to be on the lookout for Satanists. The sheriff's office never received any information about the altars, but they did get multiple reports of UFOs in the sky at night, which is interesting. So now randomly have a UFO.
Everything's happening at once.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's a portal of evil here, you know, a hell to another world. Things did eventually calm down after a few weeks, and they never really determined whether or not this was the work of an occultist or a Satanist or just an elaborate hoax set up by the farmhand Steve Ferguson, which is crazy. That why would you not investigate it as a hoax before you automatically assume this is a legitimate altar?
Everyone is going
to
die.
Right. You know? There's a secret group here about to go and sacrifice a bunch of people. But either way, the land was sold off to the next door neighbor before a third altar was discovered on the property. And they were never able to figure out who was behind these altars that were being put up. And that's the thing. There's also a lot of examples documented of people hoaxing it too.
Right.
Or just doing it as a prank. Or like people know that people are going to freak out.
People are going
to think it's funny.
Right. Like even in this case, there's a good chance that the land being sold off, he's like, well, if I make this hoax happen, maybe I can clear out the area. You know?
Like I could gain something from this.
Right.
People aren't going to want to stick around if they think a bunch of Satanists are hiding out in the woods. Right. 5 years after Brandy Hutchins was found, Arkansas was home to one of the most infamous satanic panic cases of all time. As I mentioned earlier, the West Memphis Three, which what's crazy is I don't think I've ever covered that on the show. Surprisingly. I definitely need to. I believe I covered it a mile higher,
okay.
Which is why it's been a while. But yeah, the case is absolutely insane. But if you're not familiar, here's a quick sort of synopsis. In May of 1993, three young boys, Steve Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore, were found brutally murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas. And right away, authorities jumped to conclusions and believed it was the work of Satanists. And after a very short, incompetent investigation and a false confession, teenagers Damien Eccles, James Baldwin, and Jesse Maschelli were arrested and convicted of the murders. Jesse and James were sentenced to life in prison, while Damien Eccles was given the death penalty. And after 18 years of being in prison, the three were released with new DNA evidence and an outpouring of support from the public, which led to the state offering them an Alford plea. And to this day, because of that, we still have no idea who viciously murdered those three boys, Michael, Christopher, and Steve, which is just nuts because they were so honed in on the West Memphis Three that the real killer is likely long gone and probably dead at this point.
Well, and aside from the, you know, the crime itself never being solved, the three boys who spent the majority of their lives in prison, like that's also kind of life lost, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
It's I think people don't recognize how much things like the Satanic Panic, things drummed up to an insane degree, can really affect individuals and change their lives for the worse.
Yeah, and these guys just really got profiled. You know, they wore black, they listened to metal, you know, they're kind of edgy, they just look different than everybody. Right. And so the police were like, yep, they definitely are Satanists.
Put them in jail for life.
Yep, they're our guys. And yeah, ultimately a major miscarriage of justice, and the real killer was never found, which is just horrible. I mean, it's scary to think about that. Somebody got away with viciously murdering three boys. And we'll never know, probably. Right. There's a good chance. But because this case was going on around the same time, you know, it was one that got a ton of media attention. It was one that really kind of just took the nation by storm. And unfortunately, Brandi Hutchins' case was kind of lost in all of the hysteria with the West Memphis Three. But if we jump back to 1988, as soon as the local news learned about the satanic graffiti in the old John Emery home, that was all that anyone could focus on. The media circus fixated on the possibility of Brandi being killed by Satanists and nothing else. They didn't look at anything else other than the location she was found in.
And because they knew they could sell papers.
Right. And there's a good possibility her killer knew that.
Right.
And strategically lured her to that house for that very reason. And the cops just never figured that out at the beginning, apparently. But almost every article reported on Pentagram, 666, Red Rum, and all of these different things they found on the walls. And they didn't even pay attention to who she was or maybe who she was connected to or anything that would have actually helped them solve her case. It was all about the satanic shit that they found. The county sheriff, Eddie King, only added fuel to the fire when he spoke to reporters about the investigation. And in one article, he said that law enforcement has searched other abandoned houses in the area that Satan worshipers were operating out of. And he stated, "We found candles and blood. It really appears there was some kind of ritual, but we don't know." So you think it was a ritual, but you don't know.
But you don't know. And now you're telling the press this.
Yeah. Well, and it's just crazy that they're also not telling the press. We looked at every other possible theory and possible motive and possible suspect or person of interest, and nothing else panned out. No, they just so honed in on this must have been somebody practicing, you know, devil worshiping or satanic rituals. But that wasn't all told to the press. He disclosed that the department had received an overwhelming amount of tips about occult practices happening in the county. And he went on to say this, "I'm really surprised by the number of kids that tell me they have dabbled in it. They listen to the music, devil type. They like that type of music, and they feel like they get meaning out of it. They're trying to interpret the music." So now blaming the music.
Right. Going
heavy
back.
Music, music that is scary to them. And they're like, oh, they're just acting out what they're hearing in the songs. And, you know, all these kids are doing it. It's crazy.
And it's, I mean, kind of to a much lesser extent, but we still kind of face this today. I mean,
oh yeah.
People are always turning to music, regardless of the genre now, and being like, oh, this is what's fucking up the kids now. This is what's forcing them this is what's leading them astray from God or good lives or
totally.
Whatever.
Or it's like the same thing when, you know, there's a fair amount of people out in society who still judge people with like creepy tattoos or
tattoo,
you know, someone who's got like a flaming skull or, you know, a devil on them, or, you know, even a pentagram right. on them, or wear a shirt with a pentagram on it.
It's like,
you're
boom.
Probably going to still get judged to some extent.
Absolutely.
Which is wild. Or anybody that claims to be like, if you walk around in today's society and say, I'm a practicing Satanist, you're probably going to get some odd reactions
Absolutely.
From people. And people are going to judge you based on that, which is wild when people don't even understand. Like if you're a member of this satanic temple, right? Who's just trying to keep the one of the founding principles of our nation intact, separation of church and state, right?
Pretty important.
That's like the main thing that they're doing is like trying to, like, it should be fair for all. It shouldn't just be one religion that is represented here. And people go crazy, man.
Right.
They try to put a statue of Baphomet up and people go nuts.
They go fucking, which is like, it's nothing.
Right. It's just a made up fucking thing. Right. You know, like, yeah. Why are we freaking out? But people get scared.
People get scared.
You know, if I went into my neighborhood and put up a statue of Baphomet,
dude,
my neighbors would 1,000% be complaining.
The HOA is not having that.
No, HOA is like, absolutely
no,
not.
Dude.
But if I go put a cross up outside, probably not going to get any calls at all.
No,
honestly,
dude. You might have people driving to come visit.
Yeah. Like people are like leaving notes at the door, like, love it.
Thanks, bro.
That's great.
Yeah.
So it's like, it still exists. There's very much still this fear. And I think some of, like, obviously some of it is warranted. I think there's obviously evil people out there who are taking advantage of this imagery and using it for evil. But in a lot of cases, they're really not.
Right.
They leave, that's left out of it. They're their own version of the devil. You know, they're not just taking this imagery that's existed forever and using it as much. People are creating their own versions of
right.
of hell. So it is crazy though. Like, here's a headline. Johnson County Sheriff startled after kids dabble with Satanism.
And that's
startled.
In the newspaper.
Right, right. People are reading like, wait, the sheriff startled?
Holy
he had no
shit.
Idea. This must be really bad. And when he was asked directly by a reporter if he believed Brandy's killing was done in a satanic ritual, this is what he said. A lot of people have been giving us information that would tend to lead you to believe that is involved. So a lot of people have been telling me, a lot of rumors been going on.
Yeah.
And it's making me believe that that's what happened. How about the evidence? How about the crime scene? How about who was there? How about all of these other things that he could investigate? And he's like,
I've been hearing.
People are telling me.
People are saying.
It's one of these damn kids.
Right.
Listening to this devil music. It's crazy. After the county sheriff gave his statements, the residents in the area began to think that their community was dealing with this dark underbelly of evil, evil, devil-worshipping Satanists, and that Brandy had been one of their victims. A man named Cletus, who lived near the old John Emery home, soon came forward and said that he knew of satanic rituals happening there and told reporters it looked like they were doing some crazy things. Which, could you be any more vague?
Right. They could have just had a bonfire.
It could have been, yeah. And like, it could have been kids just reenacting
right.
something they saw on a movie or a music video. I mean, it could just be anything because kids like to fuck with adults too.
That's right? One of kids' favorite things to do.
Play pranks and right. scare people. And like, it happens all the time. Here's another headline. Girl's death rekindles fear of satanic worship. So if you're just like the average person in this community reading the newspaper and you see headline after headline, how do you not think
right.
this is not going on? I mean, you're definitely going to. Then you have local pastor, Reverend Jack Glaze, who pointed out that this wasn't the first time fear of the occult had been a problem in the county, saying 4 or 5 years ago, there was talk of satanic activity in the area. One girl claimed to be a witch.
Which is just like, that's straight up witch
trial
shit.
Now we're bringing
shit.
Witches in here?
Yeah, like
God, people are just so misinformed. It's insane. And another reverend, Billy Usery, said, generally, I think it has created some fear, particularly in children. Yeah, I mean, of course children are going to be scared if their parents and adults in the newspapers
are scared too.
Are scared too, absolutely. People were so fixated on the satanic angle that the sheriff's department even brought in Carol Pate, an Arkansas psychic, to work on the investigation. She told them the rituals were done by self-styled Satanists who aren't very knowledgeable. Okay, Carol. Sure. They also consulted a satanic expert out of Texas who said they were following the right line and that it will come together real soon. And when it does, it will come together in a hurry. But it turns out they were full shit.
Right.
They had no idea what they're talking about. And this is who the investigators are consulting for help in the case.
Right.
Rather than just working the case like a homicide case.
They're not talking to the family. They're not talking about, hey, who was she planning to marry tomorrow? Like,
right. Who's this guy?
Right.
Where did he go? Who else was there? Was anybody else there? Nope.
Nope. They're bringing in Carol Pate and a Texan fucking Satanist expert.
Yeah.
Who are just also similar to the newspapers. They're getting a check.
Right.
So, of course, they're thinking like, okay.
They're going to reinforce what they want to know.
Right.
They're not going to look at it objectively and like, who knows what their level of knowledge really was either. Then there was Wes Kendrick, a Johnson County deputy at the time who would later become sheriff. And he said in a more recent 2023 interview, if my memory serves me right, after a period of time, they were not positive whether the writings were done at the same time as the crime or if they had already been there. Yikes.
That's very important to determine if your theory is, oh, this is a ritualistic murder.
How old were the writings?
Right.
Did anybody track down people who were there? Were they there before this night? You know, none of that happened. On November 18th, 1988, then Sheriff King spoke to the press again, this time with a completely different tone. At that point, he did confirm that Brandy's death was not a ritual killing, and he also made a very bold statement by saying, we are on the verge of arrest.
Which you'd think, you know, from the outside looking in, okay, we're getting somewhere, but...
This spring, if you're ready to finally see some real results, healthier gut, glowing skin, stronger hair, and steady energy, you need to add colostrum to your daily routine. And it all starts in the gut, and once your gut is right, everything else follows. And I know colostrum is good because my wife collected colostrum and fed it to our baby boy, and it's absolutely nutrient-dense liquid that my little boy gobbled up in literally less than a day. And it has so many benefits. And now you can get those same benefits, except from bovine cattle. Today's sponsor is Cowboy Colostrum. They offer the highest quality bovine, yes, that's cow, colostrum available in the U.S. Cowboy Colostrum is 100% made in America from 100% American grass-fed cows. Unlike other colostrum brands, Cowboy Colostrum is true first-day whole colostrum, rich in bioactives like immunoglobulins and growth factors. But don't worry, Cowboy Colostrum only collects surplus colostrum after baby calves have had their fill, so you're not stealing anybody else's meal. Cowboy Colostrum isn't processed and it's not stripped down. Their colostrum is whole, full fat, and high in protein for ultimate nutrient density, making it the highest quality bovine colostrum you can buy. So what does it do for you? Well, colostrum helps you in so many different ways. It can improve gut health, which improves everything else, including your immunity, hair growth, skin clarity, stronger nails, steady energy, and reduced bloating. And the results aren't just something you read about. They're something you can actually see and feel. Cowboy is easy to drink. And this is what makes Cowboy so great, is that they give you delicious, natural, no artificial sweetener flavors. They use real freeze-dried strawberries and no artificial flavoring. Simply add a scoop of their chocolate or Madagascar vanilla, matcha, which is personally my favorite, or strawberry into your coffee or smoothie and feel great the entire day. You're just chilling. You're just riding through the day. And not only will Cowboy Colostrum bring you stability to your gut, the peptides and growth factors will make your skin and hair look absolutely amazing. People are seeing visible changes like glowier skin, less bloating, real hair regrowth, and consistent energy without the crash. So for a limited time, our listeners can get 25% off their entire order. Just head to cowboycolostrum.com/lightsout and use code lightsout at checkout. That's 25% off when you use code lightsout at cowboycolostrum.com/lightsout.
3 major things happened shortly after King made this announcement. First, the old John Emery house was completely destroyed by fire. Local media didn't even cover this development. And after devil worshippers were ruled out, the news kind of just lost interest in reporting the case. To this day, there are no public details about the fire. It is unknown how it even started or if someone had a hand in it. So the place, the actual location where Brandy was murdered, is now gone, and we have no idea what happened.
With all the evidence,
right.
That remained there.
So the next significant event was Aaron, Brandy's boyfriend, actually left Arkansas and moved to Kentucky. By then, police had been investigating him as a suspect, but they never told him he couldn't leave the state. So, person of interest, your suspect, you're like, all right, man, we're investigating you, but go do whatever you want.
But if you
want
to move, no problem.
It's chill. It's chill.
If you want to go out of our jurisdiction, all good with us. Yeah. Big mistake.
Like, the police only spoke to him once, and he was never formally interviewed or even asked for a statement. The only thing he told police was that he and Brandy were not in a relationship. The last major update around this time was that Brandy's autopsy determined that she was not pregnant and never had been. This caused a lot of questions as to why she told people she'd been pregnant and how she actually obtained a positive result from a health clinic that was found near her body. And I think, an important thing to bring up here again is that Brandy is clearly, prior to her death, she was obsessed with Aaron. I mean, she loved him and she wants to marry him. And the way you get married, you get pregnant. And so I think.
Especially in this time.
And especially since she needs her dad to sign off on it or her stepfather to sign off on it. And so I don't know. I think that this is probably less strange. It still is horrible on Aaron's side because he was definitely leading her along in some way. But, I have no idea how she obtained the pregnancy result, but it still makes sense to me as to why she would tell people she was pregnant.
Right.
So in January 1989, it was reported that police had narrowed down the list of suspects to two individuals. Many people have believed that Aaron was their main suspect and one of his friends was the other. Brandy had weighed over 200 pounds, and police believed that she had been killed somewhere else and then actually moved to the root cellar. This created speculation that Aaron may have needed help moving her body. It's completely unclear how strongly police pursued these two suspects. Without naming anyone or providing details, Sheriff King later said at the time that they had sufficient evidence to make an arrest, but the prosecutors refused. Time after time, police were let down by their leads. About 4 years after the murder, a promising tip came in. Investigators searched a strip mining pit for the .22 caliber gun used in the murder, but they left the mining pit completely empty-handed. Johnson County Sheriff Eddie King said, "There have been so many letdowns in this case that as soon as you think you have something that will break it, it winds up being a dead end." Meanwhile, Aaron was free to do what he wanted in Kentucky, and unfortunately, after Brandy's death, he was linked to other suspicious cases.
Which is, man. Imagine being the authorities and finding this out.
Right.
Looking back, you're like, oh man, he may have been her guy because he's been tied to one disappearance and at least two deaths, which is crazy. So seems pretty obvious which direction they should have gone in.
Right.
Because in 1992, a 15-year-old girl whom Aaron had been romantically linked to had supposedly ended her life with a rifle that belonged to him. And Aaron was the only witness to that incident. So there's that. That's horrible and sketchy all at the same time. Another woman he was connected to also took her own life under mysterious circumstances in 2005, but it's unclear if he was at that scene or not. So you have two deaths that are ruled suicide, but there's enough mysterious circumstances to it that could they have been homicides just staged as suicides?
Right. Well, and especially in the 1992 case, if she's 15 years old,
yep.
Aaron is way past 18
right.
at this point.
Right.
He's still maintaining his same MO that he had with Brandy of finding a younger girl and grooming her.
Totally. Seemingly a predator.
Right.
Which is scary that you guys didn't do anything about that.
No.
And now you have two additional young women dead.
Right.
Because you were looking the wrong direction. And also just let him go wherever the hell he wanted
just
to go.
Just keep doing his
shit. Yeah. Insane. Both of these women's families have stated that they don't believe that they took their own lives. The most suspicious case Aaron had been linked to in Kentucky is the disappearance of Michelle Burchell. In May 1994, she had been in a relationship with Aaron, and she had previously told friends and family that he physically abused her and threatened to kill her. And at the time of her disappearance, she was pregnant. She was last seen leaving her mother's house in the passenger seat of Aaron's car as they pulled out of the driveway. Erin was supposed to be taking her to a doctor's appointment, but she was never seen again. Her purse, car keys, and some loose change were later found burned on the side of a secluded road. And to this day, Michelle is still missing, and Erin has never faced any charges for any of these violent crimes. Which, what is going on here?
It's a lot of times when we talk about these like awful, awful people, these terrible criminals who are never brought to justice, the inclination is to be like, oh, they must be so good at outsmarting the police. But no, this guy is just a fucking menace. And obviously we know why he got away with, or allegedly got away with, Brandy's murder, because, you know, the police went off in the completely wrong satanic panic direction. But in these other cases, I mean, there's just...
What are they doing?
Literally.
How come he's not charged with anything?
Right.
Not brought in, not investigated, it seems. I mean, I don't know. Sometimes I just scratch my head at some of these cases, because it feels like a lot of them happen in the South, for one.
Right.
But I just am like, what happened? Why didn't anybody do anything? And you even have the victim's family saying, we don't believe they did this to themselves. So why aren't you doing anything?
Why is this
what,
the end of the
who
road?
Who is this guy?
Right.
And does he know something? Is somebody covering for him? I don't know. It's hard not to go that route where you're like, okay, how come he hasn't been arrested or brought to justice? And you start thinking like, maybe this guy has some connection to somebody who wants to protect him.
Right.
I don't know. It doesn't make any real sense otherwise. Otherwise, just pure incompetence.
Which, I mean, I unfortunately think that's probably the case.
Right.
It's just... He's just gotten lucky in that he's only been investigated by incompetent police officers.
Yeah, insane.
So there have been some updates. Even though Brandy's case went cold, it's gained renewed traction over the years. In 2008, it was announced that new evidence had surfaced and was sent to a crime lab. However, no other details about this were ever made public. That same year, Erin's friend, who was suspected of being an accomplice, contacted the district attorney's office, and he said he would tell them everything about what happened to Brandy in exchange for complete immunity from others' charges he was facing in a separate case. Now, the prosecution refused, and he has actually never given any information about Brandy's case.
Yeah, I'm curious why they refused. I mean, maybe they already kind of knew that this was just going to be completely invalid information, right. Possibly, but I mean, it's disappointing that at least hear him out.
Like, right. Because you go.
It must have been also, he literally was like, I need some written statement here that you're not going to press charges against me if I do tell you this. And they were just like, no, we're not interested in granting anybody immunity, which is probably the case. But still, maybe it was legitimate information that you need in order to solve this case. And you refuse, so
it's just gone.
It's unfortunate.
So years passed, and the case went completely cold with hardly any attention until 2020. That's when Brandy's cousin, Julie Millard, decided to take action. Julie is Brandy's cousin through her dad, and she was one of Jerry's nieces. She was 9 years older than Brandy, which led Julie to, you know, take on more of an aunt-like role for her. She had absolutely adored Brandy and felt protective of her. Brandy even stayed with her many times whenever she would be bouncing between places. Back in 1988, when Brandy was murdered, Julie was a young mother, only 23 years old, and raising two young children. Unfortunately, she didn't have the ability to fight for justice then. But she never forgot about her cousin and always wanted answers. In 2020, with her kids now grown, Julie had the energy and time to put towards fighting for Brandy. Her first step was creating the Facebook page, Brandy Hutchins, the Disposable Child. She stated that the reason for the name was that so many people have failed Brandy in life and death. It's as if no one cared about her murder, and the name reflects it back at people, which is extremely true. I mean,
valid.
To me, it seems like she's the first person we're talking about in this episode who cares about Brandy.
Yep. And it's really unfortunate that Brandy got lost in all of the chaos and mass hysteria and, you know, all these things that were completely unrelated at the end of the day to her case, it seems. So, you know, I'm always just so impressed with people like Julie and, you know, family members who are able to just kind of pick up the pieces and continue trekking on, you know, even after all these years, to just continue pushing and continue rallying people and also just, you know, continuing to spread that awareness of this person that she loved dearly, and you know, making sure that she's never forgotten. It's just, I'm always just so blown away by people like that. It's very admirable for her to do that, and you know, which is why we wanted to help her, of course, any way that we could. So, yeah, shouts out to Julie, man.
Seriously. Many people messaged the page with various theories and stories, and while not all of them could be taken as fact, Julie was able to uncover some key information, which is incredible for a case that took place in 1988.
You know? To have information come to light.
Right.
One of the most significant theories came from an old friend of Brandy's, and for the sake of protecting her identity, we'll call Madeline. She gave Julie an explanation as to why pregnancy test results were most likely found at the crime scene, even though it was determined that Brandy had not been pregnant. At the time, Brandy would stay with Madeline, who was married and pregnant at just 15 years old, and the two came up with the idea of playing a prank on Aaron by making him believe that Brandy was pregnant. So the information seems like it adds up. So Brandy took a small cup of Madeline's urine to a health clinic and used it for the test to obtain that positive pregnancy result in her name. Police had never interviewed Madeline at the time. They also didn't even investigate why Brandy had these results in the first place.
Right.
They just straight skipped over that because this literally could be the motive here for her murder. Even though Madeline described all this as a prank, Julie has said she wonders if it really was a joke or if Brandy was trying to get Aaron to stay with her. Given her abandonment issues, it could have been a way to try to get the love and commitment she always wanted by bringing this "I'm pregnant" to him and sort of, you know, putting that pressure on him, like, you cannot leave me, like, we're now going to have a child together, which makes a ton of sense. Madeline also said she remembered Brandy talking about the birthday party being thrown for her, but didn't know who told her about it. But this wasn't the only person to message the Facebook page with new information. Aaron's own sister reached out to Julie with an interesting story. She claimed that Brandy had come over to her home after she had been dropped off at the old John Emery house. She said that she remembered Brandy cutting her bangs and talking about meeting up with Aaron. And while it's unclear if this story can be verified, it does call into question the timeline of events and whether Jerry was really the last person to see her. Julie did end up passing this information to law enforcement, but we have no idea if they did anything with it or followed up on it. That is unknown. This wasn't the only important information Julie had uncovered during her own personal investigation. She also learned that the evidence in the case was mysteriously lost. I absolutely can't stand hearing that. It is unbelievable. And it makes me wonder if there is any evidence at all.
Right. And the first, I mean, it reminds me of the Millbrook twins case that we did, where it's like, as the new sheriffs came in throughout the years, it's like, oh, new evidence lost, new evidence found, new evidence lost. And it's just, it does make you think, like, what did they even do in the first place? And are they just saying, oh, shit, we don't have it anymore?
It's just like, we never had anything in the first place, but we're not going to tell them that.
No, we can't say
that. So we'll just say that it was mysteriously lost. Or you could go further and be like, maybe they do, and they're just lying about it. They're covering it up. There's always that possibility, too. But I think the most likely scenario is they just didn't do anything at the beginning. Or it's just completely invalid. And they just would rather say it's lost. But sometime in the mid-2000s, a new sheriff was elected to the position. And before he left office, Eddie King took all the case files without permission and brought them to the state police in Fort Smith. And when the new sheriff learned of this, he demanded that, you know, the former sheriff return the files immediately. But somehow, it sounds like on the way, the transport of those files back to them, that they somehow got misplaced, which I don't believe that. Files don't just disappear like that. Something happened, and right, Nobody wants to take accountability for it, most likely. In 2008, a governor's warrant was served on his home to track down any possible evidence there, and Julie has never been told what was found, if anything, in that search. But here's a local 5 News interview from 2023 with another former Johnson County Sheriff, Wes Kendrick, and these are his thoughts on Brandy's case.
And you try to do everything you can to bring it to a resolution, and it just sometimes is aggravating to get where you know you need to be. It just sticks in you craw. There's probably not a day goes by that you don't, you'll see something that reminds you of it. As time goes by, people forget. Every day that goes by, it makes this case and others that linger around across the state and the country harder to bring to a resolution.
But in the years since, Julie has not slowed down when it comes to fighting for justice, because how can you? I mean, clearly something is very, very wrong here. This is a major miscarriage of justice, and people need to be held accountable, not only the murderer, but the people that potentially protected this case or covered it up or just were sheerly incompetent in conducting the investigation. She has organized rallies, pushed the police for answers, and garnered more attention to the case than there had been in decades. One major thing she did was contact Parabon Nanolabs, which offered to conduct genetic testing on the evidence. Julie told them that law enforcement wouldn't fund the testing, but she would try to crowdsource the money. Parabon agreed to it, but told her that under the law, a law enforcement agency must reach out to them before they can work on a case. And when Julie communicated this to the detectives, they refused, which is just maddening.
Just
telling,
like,
her, yeah.
Why? Why refuse?
Right. I mean, you're not doing anything anyways, and these guys are very reputable, top-of-the-line technology, the best of the best, and would definitely be able to provide some, you know, answers potentially, but just comfort
right.
to Julie, knowing that she has competent people working on this case. But these detectives refused, and they said that they would handle any testing, which at this point, after all these years, Julie's faith in this department is... very, very low. So you can understand why she'd want to go to a third party.
Absolutely.
And they do this kind of stuff all the time. It's just maddening. But as far as the public knows, no genetic testing has happened yet. Here's another clip of Julie at a rally for Brandy in November 2024. This is some of her thoughts on the case.
Brandy was so young, and I was, like I said, 9, and I felt like I had a baby doll, you know, and so I was always really protective of her and felt like I needed to take care of her.
When Brandy was killed, Julie was just 23 years old with 2 small children, so she couldn't help as much as she wanted. But over the last few years, she's been able to take action.
Once my children got grown and moved out and I got to thinking about it more, I decided that somebody needed to do something.
Millard says she does it because it's what her cousin deserves.
She deserves justice. We deserve answers, you know. She didn't have the best life to start with, and I think this is the least we could do for her.
However, while her case is still unsolved, there has always been one man who is believed to have done it.
Every officer I've ever spoken with, sheriff, detective, all say the same thing. They say that her boyfriend at the time is the one that killed her.
However, after 36 years, it's hard to prove, but Millard won't give up despite her claims that local law enforcement might want her to.
They wish that I would just go away and hush and not say anything about it.
And while Julie is frustrated, she's still determined. In 2025, as I talked about at the beginning, a HOPE grant from Higher Hope was granted to her, and this allowed her to buy stamps for a letter writing campaign as well as money to attend the advocacy convention to spread the word and find resources to further support her. Sadly, in August 2025, Brandy's dad, Jerry, passed away before learning about what happened to his beloved daughter. This is something unimaginable. I can't imagine as a parent. Passing away and dying not knowing what happened to your daughter. I mean, there's nothing worse. He never remarried or had any kids. And in the years following Brandy's death, he had become a bit of a recluse and was consumed by the pain of what had happened. And for 37 years, he held on to such immense guilt for bringing Brandy to that house that night. In 2023, he gave one of his last statements to the media, and he said this: "I wish I could go back and do it different, but in the end, I think it was covered up. I have multiple examples of how the police failed, and I don't know if they are still working on the case or not. They don't ever tell me nothing. I think I ought to be in the know, but they don't ever tell me nothing." Which, that is one of the most frustrating things that happens in cases like this, when the police just stop communicating. They don't give you any updates, any answers whatsoever.
Just completely left in the dark, especially after, in this case, like decades and decades of already having nothing. And then still, when other people in the family are finally making headway, the police are still just giving you nothing.
Yeah, and this is a very common occurrence. And it's just, why?
Right.
You would think that if your department mishandled a case and the family is continuing to fight for justice, that you would do everything in your power to communicate with them, to be a support, be a resource for them. Even if you can't tell them anything,
right,
at least talk to them, at least give them something. And when departments just give families a cold shoulder, or just the silent treatment, I'm just like, you're digging your own grave at this point. I mean, they are not ever going to trust you ever again. And likely the community that they live in will not trust you. So that, you know, there's all this talk of, you know, rebuilding that relationship with the communities and, you know, police departments wanting support from the communities. And it's like, this is how you do it. And there's so many departments that just don't seem to care.
No, you have to interact with the community first.
Yes, you have to talk to them. You can't just tell them nothing and expect support in return.
Right.
On November 9th, 2025, Julie organized a virtual candlelight vigil on social media as a way to honor what would have been Brandy's 51st birthday. It was also a way to keep her memory alive and continue to garner attention on her case. People participated, lit a candle at home, and posted a picture of it with the hashtags Justice for Brandy Hutchins and Remember Brandy. But Julie, she's still fighting, man. She still is updating the Facebook page, Brandy Hutchins, the Disposable Child. And we'll make sure that's linked below if you want to go send her some love and support and also follow her cause. But Brandy's case has gone through 4 prosecutors and countless personnel changes at the Johnson County Sheriff's Office since the murder. And to this day, this has never gone to any sort of trial. And it really doesn't seem to have made a whole lot of headway, unfortunately. But at the end of the day, you never know. Somebody out there may hold that missing piece of information that could lead to answers, could lead to justice being served. So anyone with information about Brandy's murder is encouraged to call the Johnson County Sheriff's Crime Tips Hotline at 479-705-8477. And one of Brandy's childhood friends has also offered a $5,000 reward for any information that leads to an arrest. But man, what an absolutely heartbreaking and just horrible way for this to end with nothing. And it's so frustrating, man. And these poor families that have to just continue carrying the torch and trying to push law enforcement officials to do things, to give them updates. It's a never ending battle.
Right. I mean, it's inspiring, of course, seeing Julie's work, like it's incredible, but it still is like in your head, you know, like she shouldn't have to be doing this. This is what the investigators are for. She shouldn't be put in this position.
No, and they should be investigating whoever this Aaron guy is.
Right.
Because it seems if there's anybody that at least knows what happened or may have been involved, it would have been this guy.
Right.
And the fact that we have no answers from him, they didn't want to talk to his sister, and he's just wherever, you know, who knows? It's, can't think of a more frustrating case, honestly. Like this is not the only one. And, you know, I hope that one day some answers are given or that she's at least able to have Parabon Nano Labs do some genetic testing, because it seems like in my eyes, if I had to think of a way this may end up getting solved, is from genetic testing,
right,
and using genealogy to track down whoever this person might be. But sounds like with the way that the Sheriff's Office handled this case, that there's very little to go off of. But, you know, never give up hope. I hope that Julie and her family get some answers one day. And we'll definitely be here to support in any way that we can. But definitely let us know your thoughts on this case. What do you think happened? And why do you think the police went as hard towards the satanic angle? Was it just the time period, or was there something else going on there? But we'll go ahead and wrap up today's episode there. Thank you for being here. But that's going to be it for me today. I'll see you guys next time. Lights out. everybody.